Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Whenever you're ready.
Welcome to the televised revolution, as we drift through outer space aboard the Absolution. With Tom back in active duty as captain, in charge of bringing superior anime action. Yeah, you came to the right place if you have a taste for animation in deep space base. Broadcast through your television due to the progress of the Bring Back Toonami Twitter mission. The same block that brought us Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z is back, so stay tuned. I remember way back, never leaving my room. I stay glued to my TV weekday afternoons. Yeah, and thanks to Adult Swim, I have a reason to use the TV in my room again. Cause every night I'll be tuning in since they going back to showing Action Tunes again. Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Yeah, Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Welcome to the Anime Action Fan Sanctuary, with Tom providing that slick commentary.
Hey there, my Toonami generation, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom's Prerogative, right here on the Absolution Network. This is episode 114. And on this episode of The Prerogative, we start Disney Month! That's going to take a large part in just 1 week. But yes, we start Disney Month right here on The Prerogative. And we start off by looking at a Disney classic from 1940, Fantasia. But yes, as I kind of alluded to, a lot's going to be happening, at least in the next couple days. I actually want to start this on Monday. There, as usual, when I'm gone for a long time, there's a myriad of reasons. I tried to do this episode in the beginning of March, and I don't know, there are certain movies and certain series, or for whatever reason, I just get on this perfectionist kick. And if I don't feel like it's going right, I'll just stop the recording and I'll just walk. I'm like, I will do it another day. I'm like, I'm not feeling this. I'm not, for whatever reason, I'm just not feeling it. And I guess Fantasia has become one of those where I just want to treat this movie with such respect. It's like, the instant I didn't feel like, okay, I'm just going to throw everything away that I've recorded so far. And I'm going, you know, just wait till I feel it again. And for whatever reason, I've had, like, a hard time getting into it. And, you know, Disney Month is one of those months where I should be very excited. It's just, I think it's just that I've not had a lot of time to, like, sit down and watch. I've been so busy and so much other stuff and everything. And, like, I kept pushing off, like, well, I'll push it off next week. Well, I'll push it off to the weekend. And then I woke up late. So I was like, okay, I'll push it off to, you know, I'll push it off and I'll do it all in spring break. And then that got afflicted because I've had a cold the past couple days, which is, I think some people can attest to this, you know, understand. Sometimes when you get a cold, it's one of those things, especially when you're on a perfectionist kick, that, you know, it's like, oh, God, I can't do it. And you're trying to do it and you can't do it. And, you know, I've finally gotten over it. And I'm like, I've finally been able to push everything out. And now I can just focus on this. So you're going to get a couple of episodes out this week. At least three. Or at least that's the plan. Is to at least get three. I wanted to have this obviously more spread out throughout the month. With this episode, I would have loved to have gotten out the first week. And what to the episode that will probably be coming out very soon after this. Coming out. Last week, but things happened, and I apologize for that. Like I said, part of it is Fantasia just became one of those movies to where I guess the perfectionist in me just came out, and I wanted to get it perfect, because I guess, well, it's not so much of a guess, but I pretty much know I really wanted to pay the respect to this movie because it's such a classic, and it's has such important meaning for a lot of reasons. And, you know, one thing is, I think, why that came about was when I first decided I was going to do Fantasia, I was really excited. And the reason being was, like, music is a big thing to me. I think everybody who listens to this podcast knows that music means a lot to me. And I put a lot of respect and a lot of meaning into the music used in a series or a movie. I mean, go back. If you look at the movies that, like, I gush about and the series that I gush about and that I just put so much praise on, you'll hear me go for 10, 15 minutes possibly just on the music. And I'll have such high praise for the music. Oh, and a lot of that dealing with Disney Month. If you go back and listen to those pieces, and you listen to the ones that I didn't have, like, big scores for, again, a lot of it had to do with the lack of music. And I put a lot into that. Because music is a huge part of any series or any movie. It's one of those verbs, it's one of those adjectives that tells the story. And is an important partner with animation telling the story. And that's the thing that this movie, as I was watching it, came about. I came to the realization, oh my god, Fantasia is that example that I have been really searching for as the perfect, complete example of how hand-drawn animation's specialty is telling a story. I talk about this a lot, but for those who may be listening for the first time, who may have not heard me talk about this, I have what I like to call the Walt Disney theory of animation categorization, I call it. But it basically is, how do you divide animation? Because I think that is a topic of discussion that's always open, I think, to opinion and debate. And for me, it's, you know, there are three distinct style, techniques, or core disciplines of animation. There's stop motion live action, traditional hand drawn, and modern CGI. Now, within each discipline or technique, there are individual styles. And with hand drawn, you know, there's anime cartoon, you know, stop motion, there's, you know, dolls, there's claymation, there's other objects, you know, puppets. And then, you know, with modern CGI, there's realistic, something like Shrek or Finding Nemo, Toy Story, photorealistic, something like Final Fantasy VII Advent, Children, or Final Fantasy The Spirits Within. And there's some others that would fall into that category that I'm completely blanking on. And then there's a third style that I feel we can put into that category that sort of is a fusion of CG, but using techniques of stop motion that I like to call machinima. You know, something like Red versus Blue, Ruby, you know, which I recently reviewed, I would feel falls into that category. Now, one of the things that I feel differentiates the different techniques and disciplines, besides keyframes and, you know, frame rate and the amount of, basically the amount of frames that are used for each second and 10 seconds of film for each individual technique, which gets larger for each different discipline, is that each discipline has a unique specialty. You know, and this is why I feel that this is that animation isn't a matter of, you know, evolving from old technology. You know, as, you know, like a camera, you know, as cameras got better, you didn't, you know, shoot in black and white, or shoot in this certain style of cover, or shoot in low definition, or standard, you know, as cameras evolved, and as cameras got better, and as the ability to translate what was on the camera better to DVD, to like VCR, to DVD, to HD, DVD, to Blu-ray, and so on, you know, that's an evolution of technology. Animation isn't that. Animation isn't, well, CG, everything's being in CG now, because, you know, it's an evolution of just putting drawings on screen. That's not what it is. each discipline has its own unique style that helps tell a uniquely different story. You know, the fact of the matter is, A Nightmare Before Christmas, Tim Burton's beloved stop-motion animation, would be completely different if it was hand-drawn or done in CG. And even though you have things like box trolls and stuff like that that do use a fair amount of CG, you know, box trolls still was, dolls and still the same technique. They just used some newer processes to help create it faster. But it still had that core definition of using puppets and taking the time to film in each individual sort of split second. Now, as far as what these techniques are concerned to, it's, you know, stop motion is the art of movement. And basically that's what I call it, is that the specialty of each discipline is their art. So for stop motion, it's the art of movement. You know, that's the illusion, shall we say, that it's trying to portray. Yeah, that's what these arts are about. They're about what illusion it's trying to portray. With CG, the art, or illusion as I'll put it, is the art of realism. You know, of necessarily fooling the eye, making you believe that what you see behind, before you, is absolutely real. And then with hand-drawn animation, it's the art of the story. That's what hand-drawn special is, because everything about the animation is about the story. And that's why music and voice acting is so important as adjectives to the verb that is animation. You know, animation is the verb to the noun that is the story. And then you take the extra adjectives of music and voice acting and such that enhance that. And there's a lot of movies and series that I feel are good examples of that. But I think Fantasia is the perfect example of that. And certainly that's one reason why I think it's taken me so long to get this episode out, because I really wanted to put the effort in for each one. And for that matter, we're going to have a different review style with this. We're actually going to review each individual piece on its own in its own form. Talking about animation and story, as there really isn't any voice acting. Because there isn't, sorry, I mean, the movie stars Leopold Sutowsky, and who the orchestra lead. Orchestra master, shall you say, of the Philadelphia Orchestra, who was the orchestra playing for this movie. And it was narrated by Deems Taylor, who was a music critic at the time, who would come out and, like, introduce each individual piece before they started it. But I came to the realization also that I really can't talk about music, because pretty much the music is the same. And music for Fantasia can be quickly discussed in the fact that it's great. You know, the Philadelphia Orchestra did a great job of playing and performing all these pieces. And the thing is that all these pieces came from either the classical or the romantic period of music. And for those who might not know the difference, classical, the definition is pretty close to like 1600s to 1700s, and more non-programmable, which means there's not really a story to the music. It's whatever you think it is, and it is more technical, has a little more Baroque decoration to it. Whereas the Romantic period is all about emotion and all about programmable music, because the music was created while looking at paintings and for ballets and about just, you know, in the landscape, just going outside, like, oh, the mood that hits me while writing this song, while looking at nature. Nature was a huge part of the Romantic period. And Romantic period remains a hugely popular period of music, mind you. Beethoven was a part of it. A lot of pieces that we are going to hear, Tchaikovsky, Savinsky, as I'm looking, Franz Schuber, Mororowski, all of these were important parts of the Romantic period. In fact, I think most of the only ones I think that are classical, actually, are, I may have to look this up, but I think it's Dukas and Bach. I know that Bach is definitely a lot more classical. But most of them do come from the Romantic period. So, all of these are classical, famous pieces. I mean, it's one of those things where listening to this music, while watching the movie, it's like each music has different parts of it. And you get to a certain part, like, oh my god, this is part of this whole Nutcracker suite. Especially with the Nutcracker suite. There are some pieces, I love the Nutcracker suite, but I forgot some pieces were a part of it. And it's like, wow. Yeah. So, that's one of the things I came to the realization I couldn't talk a lot about, was the music. Because it's all the same, it's all by the same orchestra, and the fact of the matter is, plain and simple, the music is gorgeous in this entire movie. I love every piece they picked. It's really more of a matter, did the story that they try to tell match the song that they picked? And that's what we're really going to get into the discussion for. And I've been talking about this for 15 minutes. But there's really no way around it, because we don't have the usual things to talk about with this movie, like voice acting and music, because this is such a different type of movie. This is art in its truest form, and yet it's the perfect example about what hand-drawn animation does best: tell a story. And it's just absolutely beautiful. So with that being said, let's get into the review if proper. Again, I apologize. I blanked there for a moment because as I was scrolling up on my notes. But again, Fantasia released on November 13th, 1940 in the Broadway Theater, then followed by a release date of January 29th, 1941 in the Carthy Circle Theater, followed by a more wide release of April 10th of 1942 in the United States, starring Leopold Sarkowski and the Philadelphia Orchestra, with narration by Dean Taylor. Ladies and gentlemen, let's get into Fantasia. And welcome back, and let's get right into the review. Good old sort of side note, I actually, during the break, which was very quick for you, I quickly did went back to my notes, and I apologize, I kind of was mistaken. Paul Dukas actually was part of that Romantic period, and Savinsky, who we'll be talking about in a little bit, was actually... It's that romantic period, but he became more neoclassical. But Rite of Spring was developed towards right before that. If you listen to the music, you can tell that he was going towards that neoclassical movement that had started in the 1920s for a lot of composers. But you still hear that romantic period influence of Stravinsky. Really, the only music here that is profoundly, I think, classical period, actually, is the very first segment, which is Toccata and Fugue in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach, who is, again, his pieces are just lovely, and I really, really loved the animation. Now, starting off with the animation I thought was beautiful. I thought they did a great job in the story they're telling. I love that, you know, you had with, you know, there's a lot of brass in this, but you had sort of high brass and low brass. Also, you know, depending on which the instrument it was what colors sort of came out. You know, the brighter colors were with the higher brass and with woodwinds, whereas the darker colors here were fitted with the low brass and the strings and the lower instruments. And there were some strings, of course. The higher string instruments were put into that, you know, high category. But a lot of the strings had that more earthy tone, and good reason for that, that fit with the darker colors. Just beautiful. Just the way they mix the colors to make it appear like sky and ground, which goes right into the story, because I thought it was a beautiful story here being told where, you know, you had the high instruments and the brighter colors representing the sky and the sun and everything, whereas the lower instruments, the darker colors, were representing earth, the darker, more savage earth, and ocean for that matter, because there was definitely a scene which definitely felt like it was rolling, like the rolling of the waves. That was, I thought, pretty much genius, actually. And just, it weaved the color of the animation. The animation was fluid, and it weaved it perfectly into telling the story of the sky and the earth and of water and the sky and everything. And then, of course, one thing that I felt that was like a returning theme through several pieces is the sun coming out at the end. Or at very least, they did a great job of bookending this, where this piece had it and the final piece had it. So I kind of like that bookend. See if you notice that, but like the end of this piece comes with, you know, the sun pretty much coming up and shining. So I thought overall the first segment was just a beautifully done segment, and was a great. You know, if there was a piece that needed to start it off, I thought this was the perfect piece to start off, considering what story decided to tell, because I thought it was a great example of just what this movie is going to be about. It's a great example of how, just with simple base colors and sort of, I'm trying to think of the word, and I'm blanking on it. It's an artistic word. There's a lot of artistic words. Abstract is the word I was looking for. I apologize for blanking on it for a moment. But there was a certain sense of abstract blend here with the animation, again, with the colors and everything and what instruments they were fitted with, that told a certain story, and I thought it did it beautifully. Segment 2 is the Nutcracker Suite by Pietro Ilyovich Tchaikovsky. And God damn it, this is my favorite piece in the entire movie. I loved this piece. I loved every moment. If there's one segment I will come back again and again and again and again and again and watch from this movie, this is the segment I will constantly come back and watch. I do wonder if there's a little bias there for me personally, because I've become a huge fan of Tchaikovsky due to my absolute admiration of Japanese famed video game composer Noboru Uematsu, who, again, that's what turned me on to Tchaikovsky. I was a huge fan of his, and then doing research for him years ago, you know, I found out that, you know, what his influences were with Elton John and with Jimi Hendrix, and then his want to, like, fuse that with, like, the sounds of Tchaikovsky, which is, like, that got me to realize, oh my god, he did Swan Lake, and he did Sleeping Beauty, and just these ballets, along with the Nutcracker, I think are, like, three of the most, some of the most famous ballets out there. I don't think the three most famous, but there's certain, all three of those are certainly some of the most famous ballets that pretty much everybody knows about. I mean, there are a lot of ballets, and there are famous ballets, but there are only, I think, a few ballets that if you say their name, oh, everybody knows that story. Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, and Nutcracker are three of them. They all are from Tchaikovsky. And, of course, this is the Nutcracker Suite. And, you know, again, one of the things I think that's very interesting about this movie is basically a lot of, with all these songs, some are more directly, you know, telling the story that the song is telling, you know, like with the Sorcerer's Apprentice and with Night on Bald Mountain, and Ave Maria, for that matter, which we'll get to. But here we have them, and certainly fitting some of the themes in music, as we'll get to, you know, again with, you know, the Chinese dance, the Arabian dance, and the Russian dance, and so on. Because, and that, by the way, Nutcracker Suite, it's these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 songs. Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies first, followed by the Chinese dance, followed by the Dance of the Flutes, followed by the Arabian dance, followed by the Russian dance, and then Waltz of the Flowers. And that last one makes me kind of laugh, actually, because, again, it's how they changed it around to tell what story they wanted to tell it. Let me start off with the animation. The animation is just, it's fluid, it's gorgeous. The backgrounds are just, oh my god, beautiful. They create, it almost creates a stage. It obviously it does, but I mean almost in the sense of, like, you feel like you're sitting in a theater, literally, from the back, and you're watching this. It's like, there's such a great form with the background that frames the center of the screen so beautifully, but at the same time, the backgrounds are just so beautiful, and the flowers and everything telling this story of this very mystical forest going throughout the seasons. Or the seasons going through this mystical forest, probably a better way to say that. It is a better way to say that, I think. With, you know, again, the first, you know, the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy being the arrival of spring, the Waltz of the Flowers being the arrival of autumn and winter, for that matter. Which, again, is very interesting because you have, and there are some flowers shown, but again, for the most part, it's showing leaves falling, and it's showing autumn, and then finishing with winter. So I find that interesting. I love the fairies. The fairies are drawn so wonderfully here. And again, they put such personality into them, especially in that Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairies, where they're doing it, and that one is waking up, and this one's sleepy, and this, and it just shows you what true art is. It's like, just little things like this that gives them just a bit of personality makes the biggest amount of difference in just how good something is. And it's just, oh my god, it's beautiful, and just the personality in just movement. And again, the story that movement is telling, when in each piece, I mean, the Chinese dance is short but sweet and just fun to watch with the mushrooms. And again, I love the colors there. The Arabian dance is sensual. There's just a sensuality to it. And I'm watching Goldfish and I'm like, I feel like I need to take a shower and I feel dirty but there's a sensuality there that just comes out that's just beautiful and gorgeous. The Russian dance is fun. The Dance of the Flutes is so gorgeous and just feels like I'm watching a ballet. What's not to love about this piece? This is just gorgeous. This is as far as I'm concerned, this is the most successful segment of the movie. It is just absolutely gorgeous. The animation is so fluid and beautiful, and the bright colors just bounce off the darker backgrounds, and the darker backgrounds create such a great frame for those bright colors to bounce off. It feels like I am watching a ballet. It's beautiful, and the story it tells, this very different story of this magical forest as the seasons pass through it, is just wonderful. Moving on to our next segment, we have The Sorcerer's Apprentice by Paul Dukas. As I made mention before, this is more of just a direct sort of almost translation of what the piece is, and this piece being a basically inspired by a German poem that basically talks pretty much what the story is about, which is, a sorcerer's apprentice, misusing his master's magical equipment and things going haywire. And yes, everything that happens in this piece is actually in the poem, except for Mickey Mouse, for that matter. And that's the thing that is really interesting about this. This is basically, actually, by the way, this is where Yen Said comes from, for those Kingdom Hearts fans. Definitely, Mickey Mouse being it made this more iconic. So, for that matter, I like the animation. The animation is very, reminds me of more traditional sort of Disney fare, like Piccolo and Dumbo, Snow White, and of course the Mickey Mouse, maybe not the Mickey Mouse cartoons, but definitely of the more serious animation that Mickey Mouse was a part of. And certainly, I think that this is definitely a piece where Mickey Mouse became iconic. Because certainly, when we think of Mickey Mouse, probably his most iconic appearance is this piece. But I thought the colors were done really good, the softness of it, the softness, and yet just the sort of the grays and the way they wove them, and it just made the location feel so real. And again, they fit the music wonderfully. And again, the story here is pretty straightforward. The telling of Mickey, deciding I'm tired of taking these buckets of water, I'm gonna get the broom to do my job, and it gets out of control, and he can't control it, and Yen Sid has to be the one to come, everything, and like Mickey learns his lessons of the basically can't take shortcuts. I thought the art told the story here. Again, it's just a very straight adaptation, and it is more like a silly sympathy than it is the more artistic sort of interpretations that we've seen the past two segments. But it's still gorgeous, and it tells a wonderful story. And you know what? I find it very enjoyable to watch. It's definitely a segment that has, for good reason, become very iconic. And I think the animation flows beautifully with the music. There's a lot of great iconic imagery. So I thought a very good segment. Now, our last segment before the break, and I'm not just talking about the break here. I'm talking about in the movie. There is actually an intermission. Because this is like a 2-hour movie, actually. But our last segment before the break is The Rite of Spring by Igor Stravinsky. And this is one of the ones that I didn't think worked. For the animation, I thought they did a good job. It had an almost sort of grayish, darkish tone to it. All the dinosaurs and animals and the story it told, the basic story is it's telling of Earth's creation. It's telling of Earth's early history, of it being created in the universe, the planet forming, and the evolution of us from, the evolution of you know, from sickle-celled organisms to dinosaurs. To dinosaurs extinction. There's just a lot of severity to the animation, and just a lot of dark colors and sharp angles, and it just... This fits more with Night on Bald Mountain, but Night on Bald Mountain, I think, has a better contrast to the rest of the movie. I mean, for the most part, this movie has a lot of softness to it, and a lot of positivity. This is an introduction of sort of sharpness, and I don't want to say evil, but more negative aura and negative emotion that here I don't necessarily think works. Because there's something unforgiving about the art. In certain set aspects, I mean, the dinosaurs are wonderful to look at. I just think the decision of the story, I mean, Rite of Spring was based off, you know, the ideas of the turbulence of spring on a meadow. Because, again, it was basically him looking at this painting and looking at, again, that whole romantic period idea. And here we're taking it to tell a different story. In this case, the creation of Earth and its savagery and the very unforgiving nature of nature, for that matter. And, of course, you can't forget that at the time this movie was made, these ideas were probably, if I remember right, were very controversial still. I mean, the ideas... I mean, to this day, Darwin's theory of evolution is still controversial. Of course, that probably has more to do with Darwinism, which people constantly probably confuse as part of the theory of evolution, which it isn't. It's something that... Theory of evolution by Darwin inspired people to create Darwinism, but they're not the same thing. And pretty much the idea that we evolved from single-cell organisms rather than just creations of God from his rib to this day is still a very controversial topic. And no disrespect to those who believe that, mind you. Again, I don't want to get into a religious thing, but I'm just stating that, again, this piece is based off the idea that it's accepted through most scientific circles that we evolved from single-cell organisms. And I'm going to try to steer away from that because there is no way anything I said, if anybody is offended, is going to get me out of trouble there. So I'm just going to take my lickings, whatever may come of this, and move on. But I just thought the story itself was... bit too savage for my take. I mean, unlike Night on Bald Mountain, there's no give on this piece. And it's savage from front to back. It's very dark. And the grays just give it this very gloomy tone to it. It's the one piece I think that didn't work at all in this movie, and it's definitely, in my mind, the worst segment of the movie. So with that, I'm trying to take a break, because like I said, this movie does have an intermission, and it does happen after this segment. And when we come back, we're going to get into the last segments of the movie. On this break, I'm going to play a couple of promos for some friends who I hope you certainly check out. And when we come back, we're going to get into segments. We're going to get into the introductory segment for the second part of the movie. And then we're going to get in segments 5, 6, and 7. So I will be right back, folks. After these messages, we'll be right back.
Imagine the world you have known all your life suddenly begins to change.
The changes are almost imperceptible at first, but soon everything comes crashing around you.
Past and present contradict each other. History is no longer immutable.
Inconsistencies begin to pop up. New origins rendered stories only a few years old null and void.
Those long gone are no longer dead.
Worst of all, your friends and loved ones are vanishing. Or changing.
The very fabric of reality surrounding the DC universe is unraveling.
In Smallville, Jor-El and Lara have returned to take Superman back to an unexploded Krypton.
In Metropolis, Superman is faced with a multitude of Batmen.
The time stream, made fragile by countless twists and myriad travelers, is now spinning out of control. Time is running out. Quickly.
Only the greatest heroes of every era and reality can stop this crisis in time.
And stop it they must, or the DC Universe will cease to exist, perhaps never to have existed at all.
The heroes and villains of the DC Universe are facing their Zero Hour.
In 1994, DC published Zero Hour, Crisis in Time, a 5-issue miniseries designed to fix some of the continuity issues that had cropped up since the conclusion of the Crisis on Infinite Earths.
This was a huge deal, and because of that, and because Superman played such a large part in that story, From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, hosted by Jeffrey Taylor
and Michael Bailey,
will be covering these Superman issues, as well as Zero Hour itself.
We will also be looking at all of the official crossovers to the series, in addition to devoting several episodes to the follow-up event, Zero Month, where Superman meets a brand new enemy.
Conduit.
Zero Hour.
Zero Month.
Only at From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast. From Crisis to Crisis can be found at the Superman homepage, which is located at www.supermanhomepage.com, and is part of the Superman Podcast Network, which is located at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
Also be sure to check out the Fortress of Baileytude, which is located at www.fortressofbaileytude.com. There you will find new episodes of From Crisis to Crisis, as well as all kinds of fun bits of business connected to Zero Hour and Zero Month.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
Greetings, podcast listener. Do you like
Gotcha Man?
Or maybe
Dragon Flame?
How about
Tatsuo Kaneda?
Or
in the year 1999, an abandoned alien battle fortress crash landed on the planet Earth.
Our most brilliant scientists and engineers spent the next 10 years reconstructing the damaged ship and studying its highly advanced space technology called Robotech.
Do you remember?
Our Star Blazers!
Or this?
The year is after Colony 195. As the world constantly changes in the chaotic era, there are two mobile suits that could turn humans into the ultimate weapon. The Wing Zero and the Epion.
Or maybe even this.
After the desire for blood rules all, the only hope left is the one they call D.
Or this.
Gene, grab more ships, dead ahead!
It wouldn't be fun otherwise. Let's do it!
Or...
If Cardis is allowed to be reborn, she'll destroy Marmo as well as Lodos!
Or have you seen the latest episode of...
And just like that, everything changed. At that terrible moment, in our hearts, we knew. Home was a pen. Humanity, cattle.
If you answered yes to any of these questions, then you should check out Anime Freaks, hosted by Dr. Bill Robinson and me, Gene Hendricks. Anime Freaks is a monthly podcast covering all things anime. It is available at twotruefreaks.com and on iTunes under Two True Freaks Presents Anime Freaks.
Superman.
Captain Marvel.
Batman.
It is 1985.
Robin of Earth 2.
Sergeant Rock.
The Legion of Superheroes.
This is the most eagerly awaited comic book event in 50 years.
Tommy Tomorrow.
Jonah Hex.
Commandy.
It will one day be called the greatest comic book event of all time.
Swamp Thing.
Wonder Woman.
The New Teen Titans.
The Haunted Tank.
Infinity Incorporated.
Worlds will live.
Green Arrow.
Worlds will die.
Supergirl.
The Flash.
And that is only the beginning.
The Justice League of America.
The All-Star Squadron.
The Huntress.
Ariane.
The Metal Man.
Firestorm. The Nuclear Man.
The Outsiders.
Green Lantern.
The Blue Beetle.
The Crime Syndicate.
Warlord.
The Guardians of the Universe.
Tales of the Justice Society of America proudly presents...
And many, many more.
Crisis on Infinite Earths. The DC Universe will never be the same.
It's the end of the world as we know it. Coming January, only at twotruefreaks.com.
And welcome back, and let's get right back into it. Now, when we come back from intermission, the orchestra, you know, it's something that also happens at the beginning of the movie. At the beginning of the movie, we see the musicians coming up and getting seated and, you know, practicing and, you know, getting their instruments tuned and everything. And we see the same thing as we come back from intermission as well, to where, you know, they leave and then they come back after the card, the Fantasia title card is lifted up, and they do some jam sessions to get back in the groove with some jazz music and things. Now here, as they're practicing and getting tuned and everything, there is a thing that they have called Meet the Soundtrack, where Deems Taylor sort of has the audience meet the soundtrack, which is this white line, and shows how different instruments can, like, make the line look different. And how the, you know, again, from, you know, a trumpet going off to a clarinet and hello and hi and everything like that. It's very interesting. It's more educational, if anything. Doesn't really, I think, add or take anything away from the movie itself. Our first segment is the Pastoral Sympathy by Ludwig van Beethoven. The animation, I love the colors. I love all the creatures. The creatures are so beautifully done. There's just such a great sort of classical Greek feel to these creatures that I think works so well. And it would make sense because, again, we're talking about creatures that are pretty much considered part of Greek mythology. I mean, we're talking about Pegasus, centaurs, satyrs, Cupid, and all creatures like that. And so I think that's just beautifully done. The like I said, the animation is bright, and even in the part where it gets a bit dark, and you have Zeus creating the thunderstorm to rain on the parade of again of Bacchus, who's the god of wine. He's also the god of the feast. If I remember right, he's also a god of orgies. I may be mistaken on that. I have to look that up. It's also known as Dionysus. He's the god of alcohol. Theater! I'm sorry. Yes, I know. I was probably thinking of Aphrodites. But I just remember that he's like the god of party, is basically. He's the god of wine, feast, and of theater, which is kind of funny, you know, again, because we are doing a bit of theater. Just ignore my pervertedness here. Even though we did have nudity in this, technically, in this piece. I mean, we showed women's bare breasts. We just didn't show any nipples. It's like, I'm watching, like, I can only imagine how outraged the parents of 1940 must have been when their children were, wait. They weren't? They considered this art? God damn, we could get away with a lot in 1940. Not really, but disco would be on this bit. Because that's what it is, a bit nonetheless. Again, the story is pretty much simple. It's telling of, I guess, this day in this magic forest at the edge of Olympus where, I guess, it's spring and Pegasus and, you know, comes and the Cupids are there and the centaurs are, again, the female and male centaurs are sort of pairing off as mates and they're about to have this feast as part of this festival for honoring Bacchus, which is then interrupted by Zeus because if there's anything every story about Zeus has ever proven, it's that Zeus is a dick who just decides, hey, I want to throw some lightning bolts and ruin this party. Because, like I said, Zeus is a dick. You know what? Best example, go to Epic Battle Raps and watch that Zeus versus Thor theater. That tells you everything. But like I said, animation is gorgeous, and it just tells the story wonderfully. I guess in talking about the story, I also can't escape the controversy that is apparently with this scene. Here's a scene where they have a black centaur rubbing the foot of a white centaur. I think people say that it's racist, and that's depicting of, you know, that blacks are supposed to be subservient to white. I don't know. I can't sit here and tell you that that's the artist's intention. I don't think it's the artist's intention. I think sometimes we're like, well, these colors will work good with each other. I think overall that's what an artist thinks. They're not thinking, well, this could possibly be taken as racist or, you know, as insulting. Considering some recent events in geek culture about variant colors, I think this is something to talk about. You know, nobody ever really wants to offend anybody, a particular artist. I think most artists, their mind is centered on, like, you know, this is what I want to go with and this is what I want to create, and there's really no thought about it being offensive or tone deaf as it is. I think this has become more of an issue recently because of social justice warriors that want to, like, say, well, this is what a person could think. To which I say, yes, this is what a person could think. A person could also think this, and I think this is a case. I don't think most people would look at the black centaur rubbing down the foot of the white centaur and think, ooh, black should be subservient to white. I think they'll just think it's a centaur rubbing the foot of another centaur. I mean, to be quite honest, I watched this. I don't know if it's been taken out or whatever. Because I really can't remember the scene, but I don't think if I would have seen it, I would have thought, wow, black should be subservient to white. I was like, that centaur is being really nice to the other centaur. And that's not being tone deaf or being insensitive. That's something there. I think it's an example of how far we come. You know, that I don't think of it. Because I don't think anybody's unequal. And I don't think we take that approach a lot. I think we look sometimes for, you know, to say that this is insensitive when most people don't even realize it is because they don't think like that. They don't think about, no, he's subservient to him because he is black. Because we're not thinking that he's being subservient. We're thinking, hey, he's doing something for the guy. Or the girl, or whatever. Again, not really any way to segue from Curtis' very sort of politically charged and sensitivity charged issue. But I think too much is put into it. I really can't recall the scene being there, which means, again, I watch this on Netflix, so it's probably taken out. But I also think that sometimes when we are influenced by political motives and we feel like there is injustice in the world, sometimes we implant that injustice on the films that we watch and create controversy for a film that really isn't there in the first place or was never intended to be there. Again, it's that great example of as influential as film can be, a lot of times that influence of a film comes from what we put into the film based on our own beliefs. And I just want to tackle that thing for just a couple minutes because I didn't want to seem like I'm sidestepping it because it is a controversy of this film. And I think that's I feel it's unfair because this segment is just gorgeous. Beautiful art. I love the way the creatures are rendition. It just has such a classical feel, as I've aforementioned. I think it fits well with the music, kind of. I mean, it's beautiful, and the way they work with the music as well, it just may not have been my first choice. It's, you know, they make it work. I think I'll leave it at that. I think it's the best way to say it. And the story is definitely well told. It's just telling of this day at the foot of Olympus. They have this festival. Zeus is a dick, ruins the festival, but everybody survives, and then the day comes to end, and everybody goes to sleep. Our next segment is, as I go to my notes, and I apologize, segment six is, or seven, if you include the intermission, I haven't here, but is The Dance of the Hours by Amelia Kerr Ponticelli. My first thought is that while watching this segment, it's like, wow, so all these pieces came from this ballet. It's like, that's interesting to know. I think this has also become one of Fantasia's more infamous segments because it's just such a weird segment. This is definitely the one that's out there. This was definitely a silly sympathy piece. This is definitely the most cartoony and more kid-friendly piece of the movie, with, you know, the ballet dancers, and you have the ostriches and the hippopotamuses and the elephants and the alligators as ballet dancers. I think it's safe to say that outside of Sorcerer's Apprentice and Night on Bald Mountain, which has come after this, this is probably like either the third most famous, probably the third most, or at least the third most remembered piece of Fantasia. And, you know, it, the music, I mean, the animation is bright and colorful, and they have great softness, and it's just, obviously they had fun with it, and you could tell they were having fun with it. I just don't know if the story works, because the story is too... I could follow the story. That's the thing about it. I could definitely follow the story, but it's just very, very weird. And that's the thing about it, is it's very weird and very cartoony, and kind of like The Rite of Spring. I think The Rite of Spring's biggest misdeed is that it just felt so different, felt like too much of a contrast from the rest of what had come before. Whereas with Dance of the Hours, even though it's more bright and has a lot more soft colors, but because it's very much more cartoony and much, it just, this segment just feels like from a completely different, in fact, it feels like this would have been best on its own as a silly symphony, because again, you know, the other segments, even Rite of Spring, has had sort of this very sort of painting-esque style to it, to where it feels like you're watching moving paintings. Even Pastoral Sympathy has that sort of, it feels like I'm watching a Baroque classical painting come to life. This is just straight up cartoon, is what this feels like. This was the kids segment. And I'm not saying it shouldn't be in the film, but in being critical of this film, it's such a contrast from the rest of the film. As memorable as it is, I don't think it works for the film in general. I think this would be probably best as sort of an individual piece left on its own. You know, you could even say this could have even been an intermission piece, like, you know, for those, it's time for an intermission, so enjoy this lovely little piece for your intermission while you go and get popcorn, and it plays. Maybe done something else for that matter. But over, you know, again, I think it is well done. I think the animation is well done. The colors are beautiful, and it's just, its cartooniness does not fit with the rest of the film. But it tells its story wonderfully, and I definitely see how the hours of the day are presented. It's very hard to see, but you kind of get it. And that's another reason why I think it's not as good as the rest of the movie. I don't think it's a failed attempt, but I think they missed the mark on a couple places, definitely. Our final segment is probably the most famous. Or at least, it's right there with Sorcerer's Apprentice as the most famous piece of this movie. Night on Bald Mountain by Modest Mussorgsky and Ave Maria by Franz Schubert. With Night on Bald Mountain be the more memorable piece of this segment. The whole point of this segment to show that was to connect two pieces that were so vastly different. And on that premise, I thought they succeeded. It was absolutely beautiful. Starting off with animation, my God, the dark colors and everything, it just oozed evil in the Night of Bald Mountain segment, which is just wonderful. I may bring this up next episode because the past weekend I went and saw Cinderella, and one of the things that made me love the film more than Maleficent was, again, the fact that Kate Blanket, I believe, I'm probably butchering that name and I apologize, as Lady Tremaine, just oozed the app. She was absolutely enjoying being an evil villain, as opposed to Maleficent. And that could also be because of writing everything. But it's like, I love when evil is allowed to be evil. we're not going to try, well, evil is this, because evil is, you know, you do feel bad for people who are evil. No, 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 no. Evil is evil. And there are just some evil people. And Chernobyl, you know, or however you pronounce his name, I prefer the name that Dean Taylor uses, Satan. Or as, you know, the nostalgia critic would say, Devil! He's the devil! That statement by Deems Taylor, yeah, that pretty much, I think, puts that thing to bed. Yes, his name in this is Chernobyl, but basically he's supposed to be the devil. Let's not make any bones about this. And I completely... Okay, I like blanked on where I was there, so I apologize, folks. Because live podcasting is awesome. But, you know, again, just the evilness in the animation just works so well. And then the brightness and just the warmth and just the overall good felt from the animation, or at least from portions of Ave Maria. I definitely think that Ave Maria is the weaker of the point, in particular in the middle part of that production, because there's the ending part that you get that really works, and then there's the beginning where, you know, it's dispelling evil and they're going back to their locations and everything, and you have the lanterns that work, but there's a middle part that I get lost in. And then again, that goes to story. That middle part of Ave Maria, fortunately, doesn't hurt the piece. I still think it's a beautiful piece. Because, again, you have... It started on this great foundation of Night on Bob Mountain. And that whole story of the devil rising, the spirits of evil, the ghosts and everything, and the demons that have this party on the mountain. It's just beautiful. It's just so well done. And it's become so iconic for good reason, because that music is so... timed with the music, it's so deafening and everything, and it just creates this wonderful scene that I could watch over and over and over again. It's... Oh my god. Here's where those sharp edges and everything work so well for the animation and for the music and for the overall story. Chernobyl's design is just wonderful. It's like just so, like I said, just that evil. It's like there's no definite. This is evil. This is evil personified. When you have nightmares of the devil, this is what you think of, and for good reason. And like I said, Ave Maria. I love the transition. Excuse me. I'm gonna find the right word there somewhere. Because I could speak English. but I love the transition here from Night on Bald Mountain to Ave Maria. I think that works well. And again, the beginning of Ave Maria and the end of Ave Maria are both just excellently told through the art. And again, that whole thing at the end with the sun rising and you know, being the ultimate tool of good to dispel the demons. Is beautifully done. Again, it's just that middle piece to where they're in the woods and you're like wondering where are they going with this, and it's like I think the problem is that it's just too dark. Is that you're supposed to be telling the story of sort of daylight starting to come, and it's just what they're trying to do is trying to showcase the, you know, it's darkest just before the dawn, but. When you had the segment before with Night on Bald Mountain, I think it needed a bit more brightness. And I think that's the one criticism I have of this segment. But overall, I thought it's a beautifully done segment. And I thought it was just it's a great bookend ending piece for the movie. Because I look at any of the other segments, and I don't see how any other segment could have ended the movie better than what Night on Bald Mountain. It's a set piece that's set there to end. It's like, it's the finale. Boom, there, it's done. And it's a great ending for the movie overall. I guess overall thoughts, I'll give my top three favorite segments. Number three, as I'm looking up, number three would be the Pastoral Sympathy. Number two for me would be... Actually, let me take that back. Number three would be Sorcerer's Apprentice. Number two would be Night on Bald Mountain and Ave Maria. But my number one, like I said, is Nutcracker Suite. Those three segments, to me, are the most iconic of this movie and are just the most well done. And I'll sit here and say this, Pastoral Sympathy being number four, with segment one, Toccata and Fugue in D minor, being number five, with Dance of the Hours being number six, odd enough being the sixth segment, but with Rite of Spring probably being the worst for me. Overall, I thought this was really, really well-done movie. I think one of the strengths about it is I thought they did it... It's kind of like booking in a wrestling match, you know, because you have all these different segments, and like, well, which segment works here? I think it had a strong beginning, it had an excellent end, and definitely the first three segments just built and built and built the movie to where it could recover from, I think, a misstep that it had with segment four of Rite of Spring. And I think having an intermission after that helped in some part. Because even though it's a misstep, you still had people go to it like, what are they going to come up with next? And then Pastoral Sympathy and Dance of the Hours definitely were a lot more whimsical and kept people in the seats. And then you hit them with that finale of Night on Bald Mountain and Ave Maria that just... It's a great finale piece for the movie. Overall, this movie deserves its iconic praise and its, you know, iconic place in animation and in just film history. It's, again, like I said, it's just a great example of the art / illusion of hand-drawn animation being the art of telling the story. And how animation, in particular hand-drawn animation, you know, the soul of it tells that story. Because, again, it's particularly when you look at the Nutcracker Suite and Night on Bald Mountain, Sorcerer's Apprentice, you can, but it wouldn't be the same. And I don't think it would have the same iconic feel that it has here if it was stop motion or if it was CG. Because, again, there's a certain soul from the artist's pen for every line, every mark, and every even imperfection that's a part of it that helps tell that story. Because at the end of the day, the part of this that's supposed to make you feel these stories is the fact that all of these, with the probably exception of Dance of the Hours, like I said, feel like they are paintings come to life. And that's the whole point, in particular, of most of these pieces, which were done during the Romantic period, is being that they were influenced by paintings and poems and stories and everything, that they came from paintings and stuff like that, and were influenced by that. And so, again, it's just that interconnectivity feel. Fantasia is a wonderful, wonderful Disney classic that I highly suggest for everyone. I think there's a segment there everyone can like. You know, I didn't like The Rite of Spring, but there may be somebody else who does. The fact of the matter is this movie has something for everyone. There's a segment for the kids. There's a segment for those who love ballets. There's segments for those who just love classical pieces. There are segments for those who love dinosaurs. There's a segment for those who love cartoony stuff. There's just some for those who love sort of classical Greek. There's those segment for those who love the sort of religious aftertones of music that really influenced music from the Dark Ages up to 1900 and still influences it as well with Night on Bald Mountain. That classic battle of good versus evil being told there in Night on Bald Mountain and Ave Maria. Overall, there's something here for everyone. It deserves its classic status. And it's definitely deserving of being considered one of the best probably animated movies Disney's has ever done. It's definitely a movie I will watch over and over again. Not constantly, but definitely there are individual segments where I would love to, like the Nutcracker Suite. I will watch that over and over again. And there are other segments that are, I would be glad to watch over and over again. And I think that's the one thing, is that the movie is a bit too long. It's definitely a movie that, you know, you'll watch segments, but unless you really love everything about this movie, I don't know if everybody would sit down and watch the entire movie front to back, but you at least deserve once to sit down and watch it, because I think every segment is at least deserving of being watched once. So, overall, I give Fantasia from 1940 a 4 out of 5. Not quite perfect, but damn near close. I think the missteps are in Rite of Spring, which is segment 5, and in segment 7, which is the Dance of the Hours, but only because I don't think they work as well as they can. Or with Rite of Spring, since I just think that it was just a bit too savage. And that hurts my overall rating, but again, the hard part about that is, it may not work for me, but for other people, it would. But yeah, 4 out of 5 for me for Fantasia. I hope you enjoyed this review. Like I said, I really did put a lot of work in wanting to pay the respect to the music and to the animation and everything. This review was a little bit different, so I hope you enjoyed it. And I do apologize for probably going off a little bit of political tangents there. It's just for pastoral sympathy and I was trying to, well, I can't remember what the other one was. There's another one where I sort of went off on the sort of the Batgirl variant cover controversy a little bit, which later in this week I will be talking with Edwin about on one of my other podcasts, which I'll get into in a second, but I felt those parts, it was hard not to talk about those segments. But if you have any email or comments or anything you want to leave this show about that or about this review in general, about any review I've done, remember there are several ways you can contact the show. One, you can email me at absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. That's absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. You can also leave me a comment on Stitcher, which you can find at www.stitcher.com, and search for the Absolution Network. Like us and listen to the podcast there and leave us comments. You can also find us on Facebook by searching for the Absolution Network. Like us, leave us a comment there. And of course, you can always leave a comment on the website itself that you can find at www.an.132productions.com. And, of course, while you're there, check out all the other 132 Productions content. That, of course, includes my CMG's wrestling reviews, my intergalactic graphic review that I do with my co-host Edwin. Like I said, we will be recording very soon. And, by God, we're going to have a lot to talk about. I'm going to be in rant mode engaged on that one. Tom's Top 10, along with other things. Of course, you have the Anicast, you have the Otaku Momentum, you have Shintaku Girls Wrestling and video game videos, and John Ramos's, you know, anime convention and voice acting videos, along with his Toku videos like Toku Apocalypse. And of course, make sure you check out my other websites. That of course includes Comic Book Crazy at www.comicbookcrazy.com, where you can find the Comic Book Crazy, my former comic book podcast, along with Hexcast and Spectacular Webs. And of course, my Tokyo SOS, a Godzilla podcast that you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And of course, I've had a lot of people who recently joined, and so I'm probably going to be making a new Tokyo SOS possibly this week or at some point in the near future. So thank you for all those who have joined. And of course, at any of the websites, you can check out our sidebar, where we have all our friends. I highly suggest you check them out. They do great stuff. That, of course, includes Michael Bailey and Views from the Long Box, Spidey Dude and the Clone Sucker Chronicles, Steven Slyker and the Major Spoilers Podcast, along with Critical Hit, and, of course, Scott Gunner and his Tutu Freaks Podcasting Network, which is, you know, something there for everyone. So, that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Next episode, which may very well come out later today, at least when I plan on releasing this episode, of course this could be early in the morning, we go back to the 70s. And we go back to the time of mice and everything, because, ladies and gentlemen, a little girl needs rescuing. And what better rescuers than a pair of mice played by Ava... not Ava Marie. No, I have to get the picture of Ava Marie out of my head. No, that's a horrible person. I'm blanking on her name, and I apologize, and I shouldn't. Ava Gore, something like that. The other one played by Bob Newhart. I'm going to get the names right when I get to the review, because it's really late at night when I'm doing this review, by the way. It's like almost 3 in the morning, which shows you how dedicated I am to this. But, so next time out, we continue Disney Month as we review The Rescuers. So until next time, my Toonami generation, it's gonna get too dangerous for stay golden.
Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.